What's up, y'all? Summer's got a different tempo. Everything's a little looser, brighter. One plan turns into another. You hear something, you stay a little longer. Next thing you know, you're somewhere you didn't plan to be. It's those in-between moments. That's where the ideas hit. Conversations stretch out, little memories sneak up on you. And sometimes, it's just about what's in your hand. That color, that chill. The new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks. Guava and passion fruit flavors with mango pineapple flavored pearls. Yeah, that feels like summer before you even taste it. Funny how one small stop becomes the best part of the day. Start your summer rhythm with Starbucks. Try the new Tropical Butterfly Refresher from Starbucks.
Good day. This is the making of the John Batchelor Show. I am in New England, and I'm joined by my two very good friends, Thaddeus McCotter from the great state of Michigan, and Ivana Stradner, Dr. Ivana Stradner from the Foundation of the Defense of Democracy, who's traveling in Europe. I welcome them because it is time, reading the headlines as the President of the United States enters into Beijing and conversation with Xi Jinping, it is time for us to discuss Ukraine, of course, the story that has lingered in European imaginations for years, and what is to be done. It is a surprising series of events these last months that suggests to me that Ukraine is no longer losing this battle, and suggests to me that Russia is no longer winning this battle. Ivana writes an essay in the Telegraph, that's the London Daily Telegraph, within these last hours, underlining the detail about the Great Patriotic War's parade held in Moscow every year in May 9th, and what a change was evident in the most recent parade, and what a change is in the wind for Vladimir Putin, man who has conducted this war at long distance and yet has not been successful in any studio around the world. Nothing he says has been a success. And that may be a concern for Vladimir Putin. We had the report last week from the Financial Times, sourced without names in the Kremlin and outside the Kremlin, that Vladimir Putin spends most of his time in bunkers, and where he's had reproduced his office in the Kremlin as if he's still in the Kremlin. Bizarre fact that was sitting right there in the papers. So, Ivana and Thaddeus, I welcome you this morning. Ivana, especially, I want to make it clear that what we're going to do is record your thoughts, and this will be on the radio show later in the day. It's clock management here, where you are, where I am, where the show is. But we can discuss beforehand how we want to do this. So I, first of all, want to welcome you to the show and also introduce you to my good friend Thaddeus McCotter. And Thaddeus, this is Dr. Ivana Stradner of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. And Ivana, your piece about Vladimir Putin, was it a surprise to the Daily Telegraph that you were so clear in the retreat from the martial music of these last years? I believe there were no major weapon systems in the parade. Good day to you, Ivana.
Thank you very much for your kind invitation. So, indeed, Russia is not winning this war. And all you have to know is to basically take a look at Russian so-called Victory Day that Russia has been using for a very long time to promote the narrative that it was the Russia that saved Europe from the Nazis. So, and this year, there were no military tanks on the streets of Moscow. Putin also, as you mentioned, has been hiding in one of his bunkers, totally paranoid. His speech was a very short speech, basically emphasizing how the Soviet Union won the World War II and they are going to win again. But why it matters? It matters,
Ivana,
because...
Ivana, I interrupt you because this is all wonderful. Let's record it. Okay, you're ready to go. Thaddeus, you all set?
Yes, sir.
You hear Ivana well?
Yes, sir.
Perfect.
These are the digital limits. Let me set it up, Ivana, and we'll begin recording right away. 5, 4, thank you. 3, 2, come on, clock. The only non-digital thing I have is my clock, so it won't go out when everything else does. 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Thaddeus McCotter, American greatness, former member of Congress, my colleague and co-host and friend. And we're traveling to Europe, where the events of these last hours most significant. In Moscow, the Great Patriotic War Parade, held every year since 1945, had a major alteration this year, and Dr. Ivana Stradner is here to help us understand that alteration. In London, there is nothing but turmoil around the government headed by the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. The King's speech did not solve anything, and there's said to be a revolt in these next hours in some fashion from Mother England, Mother Country. Revolution is the sort of thing that America's dealt with for 250 years, and it's come again to London, where I think we learn to revolt against authority that we regard as arbitrary. Other capitals of significance this morning, of course, are Tehran, still in contest with the U.S. Navy, as far as I can see, and Beijing, where the president is due momentarily to meet with Xi Jinping, the General Secretary of the Communist Party. That's on that side of the world. We're going to attend to the European part of the Eurasian world island with Dr. Stradner's remarks about a change in the weather for Vladimir Putin, the would-be Tsar of all the Russias. Ivana, a very good day to you. Your essay in the Daily Telegraph was inspirational, especially the part where Vladimir Putin lives in bunkers, hiding from ghosts in some fashion. Banquo's ghost, I don't know whether he knows Shakespeare enough to fear the people he's slain might come out and slay him. But in any event, the Financial Times wanted us to know last week that he lives in bunkers, doesn't go to his dacha, doesn't meet with his family. In fact, spends all of his time not only in a imitation of his own office so that he can televise himself to Russia as if he's still in the Kremlin, but also poring over maps. I picture him like Stalin wanted to be pictured during the Second War, hanging over a map of Europe about what he's going to conquer. None of that is true. What has happened to Vladimir Putin? Has he aged suddenly before us? Has something gone wrong in his life? Who is he fearful of, or are these entirely ghosts? Good day to you, Ivana.
Thank you very much for a kind invitation. So you're indeed right that probably he's hiding in one of his bunkers, because like all dictators, he fears his own people. And I don't know if he's reading Shakespeare, as you mentioned, but I do know that he knows Russian history very well. And the Russians might not be happy about his war in Ukraine, but not because of some moral issues, but mostly because the Russians are becoming more and more aware that Putin is actually not winning in Ukraine. Russian economy is struggling, so he knows that the Russians are extremely becoming tired of his war. And finally, all you have to know is that for the past few weeks, there have been massive internet outages across Russia, including for the Victory Day that just happened a few days ago. So that also tells you why he's totally paranoid, controlling the information space, believing probably that, again, you know, the West is plotting a color revolution, his favorite narrative for the past more than two decades.
Thaddeus, you have a question for Ivana.
Yes, doctor. It sounds like he should be reading Crime and Punishment before anything else. The question is, in the past, these Victory Day parades, how much more celebratory have they been? How has it degraded over time to where we are today.
So Victory Day has played a tremendously important role in Putin's regime, but also throughout the history, because that's the moment when Russia wanted to portray strength abroad and loyalty at home, talking how actually it was Russia that saved Europe from the Nazi. It has, if you look at the previous Victory Day celebrations on the streets of Moscow, Russia was happily promoting all their military equipments. This year, the streets were empty. And on the streets of Moscow, you could also see North Korean soldiers, which tells you all you need to know that Putin, A, fears Ukrainian drones, B, that Putin doesn't have a lot of things to use to show off. And the very first fact that there was North Korean military tells you actually how Putin has been isolating. But not only that, Putin has been using Victory Day for a very long time to portray the Soviet Union as the one who sacrificed almost 30 million people to save Europe. And that narrative has been growing significantly in the Russian society. And that's why, for example, you have the revival of Stalin across Russia that Putin has been using. But more importantly, that Putin also used how Ukraine is based on a Nazi and that Russia is defending again Europe from Ukrainian Nazis. The same parallel that they have been using like a historical narratives, except for the fact that it's Russia that is waging one of the most brutal wars, if not the most brutal wars in Europe since World War II. So that tells you really all you need to know about that. Second thing, if you look at Russian history books and how Putin has been using to portray narratives and to strengthen nationalism among the youth, that also tells you how he has been using that for propaganda purposes. And to show, you know, that it was the Soviet Union alone saving Europe. What he forgot, and I think President Trump was right when he said that it was the United States that played a very important role over there during World War II, with allied support. Putin forgot to mention that, but also people forgot to mention that there was also a pact between Russia, basically back then, you know, the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. And people also forgot to mention in Russia, that it was the USSR that absorbed the Baltic states and forced a harsh war, you know, with Finland. So I think it's very important to call a spade a spade. And yes, Russia did, you know, have certain role during or to end World War II, but it's not as Putin claims that it was. It's a pure propaganda.
I'm glad you mentioned other countries that have no reason to celebrate Great Patriotic Day, because their experience after the 1945 was that of a slave or a servant to Moscow. I want to particularly ask what this apparent flagging of Putin's spirits, hiding in bunkers, is not a strong day. What this means for the demi-Putins, the semi-Putins, the junior Putins, the Putin lights of the Danube. I'm thinking of Vucic, of course, from your native Serbia, but all the other bully boys who act as if they can reproduce Moscow the way Orban did. Does Putin's retreat affect them, or are they independent?
Several things. It's not only what happened to Orban. Putin also was watching carefully what happened in Venezuela, but also what's happening right now in the Middle East. And Putin understands very well that uprising in Russia might happen. Look, I don't want to project anything because I also don't believe that Russia will become the part of the democratic West anytime soon. But indeed, I see more and more resentment inside Russia among bloggers, military bloggers, including fashion bloggers, people like young people who are becoming more and more critical of his war. Even Fico in Slovakia is changing his tune on the EU. President Vučić, who has long time been very close ally to Russia, understands that Russia will not be there to save him. Look, all you have to know is that being a friend with Putin, you don't need enemies. Putin threw Venezuela under the bus. Armenia, several years ago, when Armenia had a war with Azerbaijan, Putin, yes, is providing certain intelligence to Iran, but clearly didn't help a lot. That also tells you all that Putin is not some master 5D strategist, and some people in the West like to portray him. He has his weaknesses, and Russia, as it's waging its brutal war in Ukraine, has limited military and intelligence capacity to help other countries. So at this point, I would advise all Putin's allies to think twice if they think that Putin is going to save them.
Thaddeus, you have a question for Ivana.
Yes, Doctor. When the Soviet Union fell, we saw one of the key aspects of this was Russian troops would not fire on unarmed people. And what we're seeing now with the Putin regime, if there's any chance of type of regime change, what is the likelihood that the military would take it into its hands and start firing on people, as we've seen with Iranian mullahs killing people in the streets?
One thing that I've been observing for the past few weeks is how Russian information space operates. Every time when Putin tightens the information space, it's a signal that the Russian intelligence understands that something is happening. To give you an idea, Russian Telegram channel has almost stopped working. Russia is trying to push forward for a new app called Max. And I understand that for some people in the West, it would be like, who cares about like some random social media platforms? It matters because any coordination when it comes to protests can be organized through social media platforms. And Putin, as a former KGB guy, FYI, second-rate KGB guy, but that's a separate story, he understands that completely controlling the information space is very important. Now to go back to your question. I don't know if the Russian military will go after people in case there is uprising inside Russia, but I do know one thing, if history is any indication, that Russia operates as a system. And that means that even someone who might replace Putin will also come from a similar background with similar narratives, with similar projection of power. So I'm not very hopeful that in the coming years, Russia will suddenly become part of the West. And anyone who might try to bring Russia closer to the West will end up, you know, being perceived as someone who will betray Russia. So a lot of people inside Russia, given the Russian economy is collapsing, given that Russia is facing serious losses on the battlefield, even including some military and intelligence, are growing more and more impatient and upset with the Kremlin, how they're waging this war. Because look, Russia is completely isolated.
30,
I do understand.
30 seconds, Ivana. 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I do understand, you know, that some people might believe, you know, that Russia is a great, you know, nuclear power. That could be true, but it's also undeniable fact that Russia is losing on the battlefield and Putin struggles with economy.
Dr. Ivana Stradner of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, traveling in Europe. Thaddeus McCutter, American Greatness. When we come back, if Russia's losing, does that mean Zelensky and Ukraine are winning? I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with my colleagues, Thaddeus McCutter, American Greatness, and Ivana Stradner of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, discussing Vladimir Putin hiding in his bunkers, poring over maps, mumbling to himself. We describe Mr. Zelensky. I watched him recently arrive at a very good hotel in the somewhere in Northern Europe. There were bodyguards and there was a limousine, but there wasn't much attention to his security. He walked out, he greeted everybody. You could see the diminutive figure, smiling, and walked in with his wife to the hotel in the evening. In other words, this is a man who travels in Europe as anyone would, the head of a government that is of grave concern to the rest of Europe. How odd, I thought to myself. What does this mean? Ivana, I asked the controversial question. Is Ukraine winning? Does it think it's winning with its drone technology and its many contracts now, not only to the Middle East, but to Finland, to other NATO members, integrating its invention of the first-person combat drone? Is Ukraine enjoying something of a revival here? What's happened?
I think the drone technology has truly shifted how we wage wars these days. And Ukraine has shown that it's a real country that can help, you know, export technology and to help the West and to help also the United States. So Putin, just the very first fact that he, as you mentioned, was hiding in the bunkers. And even prior to the victory day, he warned Ukraine not to use drones because now drones can actually go deeper into Russia. That has shifted the war. But here is also another caveat that I want to emphasize. For Putin, this is a protracted war. And for him, he is not in a rush right now. He wants to exhaust the West. He wants to again start new negotiations, to renew negotiations with the United States, pushing Ukraine to give up its territory and portray Russia as a reliable partner when it comes to the fight against terrorism, or, for example, bringing like more economic alignment between the United States and Russia. And we have to be very careful about that, because even though Ukraine is doing quite well and certainly better than before in the battlefield, and now with drone technology, Putin still has numerous ways how to trick the West. And one other thing that, John, I would like to emphasize, we already saw Russian drone incursions inside Poland and the Baltic states, and Russia cutting sea cables. Russia is still waging a horrendous hybrid war against the West, tried to show that NATO is a paper tiger. So Putin still has numerous ways how to challenge the West. And the sooner we understand how Russian military operates when it comes to new generation warfare, the better. We need to strengthen our hybrid warfare teams.
Thaddeus, do you have a quick question for Ivana?
A quick question for the doctor. What is it that Ukraine has to watch out for in these negotiations? Is it the U.S. putting too much pressure on them, or should we just kind of allow Ukraine to formulate its own policy and then support them?
I think the most important thing for Ukraine when it comes to negotiations is not to fall into any emotional trap when it comes to negotiations, because that's exactly Putin, as a former KGB guy. He knows how to play those psychological games. Basically, portraying Russia as a Christian country with the United States, that they can fight, you know, together, defending Christianity, that Russia, I mean, think about this. Who is negotiating on behalf of Russia? An envoy who has a really strong background in economy, not a military guy, not as someone who's coming from Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
30 seconds, Ivana.
Because Russia understands that the United States love to talk about business. So there are a lot of psychological tools that the Kremlin has to push, you know, the United States to push pressure on Ukraine. And I think the White House has to understand that Russia is not our ally, that this war in Ukraine also threatens the United States, and that Putin doesn't want to end this war anytime soon.
Ivana Stradner in Europe, that is McCutter in Michigan. I'm John Batchelor. Well, that was wonderful. Thank you, Ivana. How do you like this live streaming? What you say is what everybody hears. Did you enjoy?
Wonderful. I'm unapologetically always saying uncomfortable things, so I have no problem that it's live, ever.
Vucic, is he in a bunker yet?
Not yet, but he's struggling.
Is he thinking about it? You know, Khrushchev's speech in 56 rattled everybody and probably led to the Hungarian Revolution. That's a guess, but it probably had contributing factors. And this report about Putin in a bunker, did you hear anybody in the information space of the Eastern European countries that were once under the boot, did you hear noise from them that they're suddenly doubtful whether Russia can prevail.
So Serbian authoritarian regime certainly fears what's happening, because on the streets of Serbia, there are still massive protests against the regime. And I mean, now with what's happening in the Middle East, as well as in Ukraine, it doesn't reach, you know, a wider audience in the West. But certainly people there are watching, and also what happened to Orban and how Russia didn't help has been very inspirational for a lot of people, whether in Georgia, whether in Serbia, whether in Slovakia, to fight against those pro-Russian regimes.
Ivana, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Now that you've done it once, I'm going to prevail upon you when you travel to talk to us. You're 5 hours ahead, 5 or 6 hours ahead. So thank you very much, and enjoy your day in Europe, Ivana.
Thank you very much for your kind invitation.
Good day.
Have a wonderful day.
We will.
You too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that, Thaddeus. Ivana, why I mentioned Vucic is that he is the bully boy boss of her Serbia, and she doesn't have any love for him. I suspect you guessed that already.
Well, not if she works at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. No.
But Vucic fashions himself as a junior Putin. And when Xi Jinping was in Europe 2 years ago, I believe, for his last visit with Europeans, on the way home from Brussels or Paris, whatever major capital he was networking in, he stopped in Belgrade and spent half a day with Vucic, which I found passingly strange. Of all the countries in all the world, why would you pick out the troubled Serbia for the Chinese supremacy, the Chinese Communist Party, to stop? It turns out that Vucic has been making a lot of contracts with China on the Belt and Road. And one of those contracts led to the building of a railroad terminal with a canopy over it. It just so happened that it was badly done. What a surprise. It broke and killed a number of young people. Well, that happened, I think, in 24, I believe. And the protests have been constant ever since, rattled his government. In other words, the Belt and Road contributed to the weakness of Vucic in Serbia, and I suspect that's true for wherever Belt and Road was. And so that's why I always ask about Vucic, because she looks forward to the day that Vucic will be thrown out of the palace, just like a lot of other bully boy dictators in the Western Balkans. It is an odd irony, Thaddeus, that while China is seen as strong, the old Soviet pall over Europe has now become laughable, as if it never existed. Or am I exaggerating the retreat of Moscow?
Well, I would think that NATO understands the threat of the Russian bear still. They're still very worried about it. They're still very worried about Ukraine. So I think the specter is there. It's obviously not as organized or as tightly controlled as it was under the Soviet Union. I resisted the fact, just to add, being from Detroit, that where do you think Mr. Stalin got all those weapons and materials to help defeat the Nazis from? You're welcome, Uncle Joe. And some of our countries were busy facing a two-front war, Mr. Batchelor, unlike the Soviet Union, who only joined against Japan right at the end so they could conquer some other territories to the east. So a lot of us had a lot on our plate back in the 40s, and we did our job, too.
All accurate.
And we never cut a deal with, like the doctor said, about Molotov-Ribbentrop, where they carved up Poland, and the K-10 Forest, where they executed the Polish intelligentsia and the military. But, you know, we weren't committing war crimes, so I guess Uncle Joe had us there.
Yes, and I was reading in the biography of Tojo. Hideki Tojo was the war minister who became the prime minister during the depths of the war, that it was important to Japan before the Pearl Harbor attack to sign a treaty of non-aggression with Russia. And so though the war was fought in two fronts by the U.S. and its allies, as you say correctly, Russia only fought one front, and that's not because it was an accident of history. That was purposeful.
Yeah. I read Gary J. Bass's Judgment at Tokyo recently. You know, fascinating, incredibly thorough book. And so, yeah, the Soviet Union was busy having a non-aggression pact with Japan while we were fighting an existential battle, not only against Japan, but against Nazi Germany. So, again, the Soviet Union played their games. We still managed not only to defeat them, but over time defeat the Soviet Union. And so Putin's narratives may be wonderful for domestic consumption, but they bear very little resemblance to the truth anywhere else.
Let's go to Europe again. We're going to the paradise part of Europe. We're going to the south of France. Simon Constable joins us from Albi in the southern part of France, where the weather's always perfect, Simon. I won't accept anything else. Simon, you and Thaddeus this morning can enjoy the perfect weather together. It's rainy here in New England. How is it with you, Simon?
It's damp, shall we say. It's damp. It's not exactly raining. It's light rain, light drizzle today. The high, 63 Fahrenheit, the low, 48. So when I got up this morning, I was a little surprised at how cold it was inside the house, let alone outside the house. Anyway, the good thing is we got roses are blossoming in the garden, all over the garden. It's absolutely lovely. So that's very nice. And the sun will come back. Otherwise, I'll put basically a complaint into God.
Simon removed himself from chilly Scotland, where the sun comes out every second year, I believe. He removed himself south of France and lives in a former chateau that was barricaded against some series of revolutionaries in medieval times. The story is quite fantastic. Now and again, he visits Albi, which is a medieval village that has been recreated perfectly and has great internet. However, he also lives in farming France. He's surrounded by the National Rally, all of whom are hardworking farmers, fields of calves, it's the calving season, and everybody's quite pleasant all the time. And the last 2 years since Simon's been there, I visit him every Wednesday to remind myself what perfect weather is like, and now when I mean to show him off, That's exactly the weather we're having, Simon, the same weather.
It does seem to be like that. Over every week we've been talking, it has been very similar, even though it's 3,000 miles away. Right. It's amazing, really.
My weather is Thaddeus's weather 24 hours ago. So I get what Detroit had yesterday. And what do you have today, Thaddeus? Is it sunny anywhere?
Well, it's not the hellscape the south of France is, but it's about 60, somewhat sunny, good softball weather.
Well, I can look forward to a day of sunshine tomorrow. Gentlemen, I want to begin with a recording that will start with the big news of the moment. It's raining in the south of France, and the roses are out. Our wisteria never blossomed this year, Simon, because of the frost we had. We had two frosts.
Oh, I'm so sorry for you. That's really. I hope it comes back double next year.
But. Well, it happens now and again when you try to grow them in cultures that have frost in the springtime. Mm. However, we're weeks behind you, so we'll start with your blossoms. But I really we're keenest on the commodities today because. Things have been spiking. You notice copper. You notice Brent crude spiking. And then, with your permission, we'll go to that rascal Starmer.
Yes. We'll give him some more attention. We'll give him some more attention. It's a good job he isn't a king from a few hundred years ago, because I think by now he'd have his head chopped off.
Causing the king to drink Pepto-Bismol as if it was milk, for heaven's sakes. The king's speech he read perfectly. Not an not a hesitation, not a mispronunciation through the speech. And then they marched out to bands celebrating. But I do want to attend your thoughts as an Englishman living in the south of France about Starmer's government, because there was in the King's speech they're going to get closer to the EU. And that is not the will of at least part of the electorate that broke with the EU. What is it, 2015, 10 years now? Is it was it 2015? I believe it was.
2016, so it was 10 years approximately ago. Years. And that was a big move, and a lot of people were quite shocked, but it really was quite a big difference between those who wanted to stay and those who didn't want to stay.
All right, we'll begin recording. Here we go. 5. Thank you, Simon. 5.
My pleasure.
4, 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor with Thaddeus McCotter, American Greatness, my colleague and co-host and friend. He is in the great state of Michigan, where it is sunny. I am in the New England part of the world, where it rains a lot. And we go to Simon Constable in the south of France, where it's said to be perfect all the time. That means sunny blue skies, big blossoms, everybody enjoying themselves as if they've gone to heaven already. But no, they're in the south of France. Simon, a very good day to you. Now, I am aware that now and again showers fall in perfection. However, the most of my springtime has been spent here in New England as chilly, very chilly. How is it with you today, Simon? Good day to you.
Good day to you, John, and good day to you, Thaddeus. This morning, it was chilly when I got up, and that was indoors. When I got up and went into the kitchen to have a cup of coffee, I could find cold coffee, and the atmosphere was cold. It warmed up a little bit, so the high was 63, and the low was 48. These are Fahrenheit figures. If it was 63 centigrade Celsius, that would be really, really hot. It's been cloudy with some light rain. And when I say some light rain, it's something that most British people wouldn't even notice. But I've gotten used to being in the south of France, so I get a couple of dots of rain on me, and I notice them, not that I mind them. Anyway, it is nice. The garden is looking nice. We've got roses blossoming, pink roses and white roses all coming up, and hopefully some red ones soon too.
Are your irises still with you, or are they fading?
They're still with us, surprisingly. They're keeping going, and trimmed up some ones that are crinkled up, as they do after they've let their seeds out. So we've taken some away so that they don't suck energy away from the bulbs down in the ground. But hopefully they continue for a few weeks.
And my concern always for the wisteria, yes, of course, and also the question of how your general pastures are doing. For example, your plums, how are they doing on the vine?
The plums are doing very well. They are a little way away from being soft enough to pluck them off the tree, and we've got two at the moment that are looking not two plums, two trees. One is a cherry plum, and one is the yellow one, which is a Mirabelle plum, and neither of them are ready to be picked yet. But when they do, they'll all come at once, and we're looking forward to that. So they're looking healthy, both trees. And that's good. And then we've got another set of trees which produce these blue plums, and they're quite big, maybe about 2 inches across. So we're looking forward to that later on in the year.
I've learned, Thaddeus, that the reason they look for the plums to be ripe in the south of France is that they make it. Do you use the inelegant word hooch in France, Simon? I
don't. They call it eau de vie.
I see.
And I've once had a drink of this, thinking it was wine, and I was pretty sure that my head was going to explode when I had this sip. It was very strong. I mean, very strong beyond strong, and I never touched it again.
Now, Simon, you've got to enter into the spirit of living in the south of France.
Yes, or maybe I'm just a weakling on that front, but it was a nice gift we got from a neighbor who's unfortunately died recently. But that was the gift, and we've still got it because I haven't touched it since. So if you ever want some of this hooch, it's there, and it's not going to go off because it will kill all bacteria, and possibly me if I try it again.
All right, now, the walk with Lara and Juno. Is their calving more evident, and how are the berries?
The berries are all coming up. and they will be coming up again. They're not ripe yet, so we can't use them. There are a lot of hares around, and the dogs get very excited when they see a hare, and they run very, very, very fast after these hares, and the hares just go that little bit faster with me shouting after the dogs to come back and stop it for a little while, because I don't know what they'd actually do with a hare. Probably would just want to kiss it or something. That's how the dogs are.
What about the calves? Did you see more of them?
Yes, a heck of a lot, actually. In one of the fields that's about a mile away from our home, and pass it frequently, has such beautiful little, almost furry calves around with their mothers and looking very happy. And it's really sweet. It's a nice thing to see. It's a very spring thing you want to see. Unfortunately, we don't have any sheep in the area, and so we don't see the lambs. Anyway,
all right.
It is what it is.
We've celebrated the south of France. Enough of this. Now it's time for bad news, okay? We're ready for the commodities. So let's start with the energy complex. Brent crude is what you pay for, and electricity is what you pay for. I looked at Brent crude in these last hours, bobbing around 107. How is it with you in France?
It's 108, so it's fluctuating a tiny bit. It's up 14% on the month. So a month ago, it would have been that much lower. TTF, which is the electricity level, and that's 47 euros per megawatt hour, and that's up 9% in the last month. Natural gas is $2.84 per unit, and that's up 9% as well. So again, all of these things will add to the cost of everything else that you have, which isn't very good. And that's not fantastic in any way. The one thing we do see going up that might be a good thing is copper. Copper is now $6.60 per pound, and that is a brand new record high for that. And that's unfortunately again 9% up. The all-time high there, and I think that's probably a lot of data center use for AI, artificial intelligence.
I note that the prices here differ in energy prices. We're paying $4.75 a gallon for gasoline in Connecticut, and $5.99 for diesel, which is not – you're paying over $8, close to $9 for diesel. Thaddeus, how is it with you in Detroit? What do you have a gallon of gasoline and a gallon of diesel? Do you know those numbers?
I know Costco was about regular. Was about regular unleaded was about $4.40 a couple of days ago.
$4.40 Costco. That's the best price you can find in the area. Is that correct?
If it wasn't, I wouldn't have used it.
I see.
And Thaddeus, if you ever get any of that and you can bring it over to Europe, we'd all be very happy with $4 or even $5 per gallon. That would be fantastic.
And my new role as a gas smuggler.
Simon.
It could be exciting. You might enjoy it.
Simon, have you got any empty pumps this week where the farmers use diesel?
No. We haven't had any problems with that. The diesel has been there, and that's the one thing they do keep open all the time. I've seen other things like gasoline being taken off for a while, and some of the eco-friendly fuel that's put in certain cars, and that's been disappearing occasionally as well. But the diesel seems to always be there. Thank goodness that.
One more detail about the food complex. Any change in soybeans or corn?
Yes. Corn is up 5% on the month. It's $4.66 per bushel. Soybeans are up considerably as well. They're up $4.8 to $12.15 per bushel. And wheat is up as well at $6.67 per bushel. And that's up 12.8% in the last month. So all of these things are inflationary. We're seeing food going up. I was listening to the radio this morning from Britain, and they were saying that a lot of things like pasta and bread and all that sort of stuff were up about 100% during this period where we've seen energy prices go up massively.
And underlying,
not good.
Underlying the food complex is the fertilizer. That's what is dear. I believe that urea is up 50% or some huge number.
Yes.
And that's
it's about that.
It's all the Gulf troubles.
Yep.
And the planting going on. Well, one more commodity before we go. Gold and silver. Are they showing any fear factors whatsoever you can see?
So silver is, but gold isn't. So gold is down 3% on the last month. It's still remaining below $5,000 per troy ounce. And silver is up 10% over the last month at $87 per troy ounce. So it's sort of, you know, wobbling around there. And you come back next week and it'll probably be the opposite of that.
We have a producer price index number this morning in Wall Street that nobody is happy about, 6%. Year over year, because of the cost of commodities that you've been talking about and gasoline.
Yep.
So we're jumping badly. And Thaddeus, inflation is, I call upon your political hat, inflation, is it the killer of administrations that it is sworn to be, or are there other factors that we need to pay attention to?
Well, no, it certainly doesn't help, John, but the other factor to look at, and I believe that it's regressing, is the take-home pay versus the rise in inflation. So inflation's outpacing what people are taking home. And that's political death.
So the story in Britain and in France, we can testify, is that government would be in trouble. Is that a fair generalization?
Well, when prices are rising faster than your take-home pay, yes, you generally have a problem. You certainly have a problem around the hearth of home, and people tend to vote on the economics of the situation.
I would say that London has a problem then if it's up 100%. Would that be wrong?
So does the United States.
Yes. Well, Simon, that's we're ringing the bell for you when we come back, Simon, because I hear your government's in trouble. Okay, Simon Constable, with the hooch in the cabinet because he daren't touch it except for when a visitor comes. In the perfect south of France, we're headed to London, where the King's speech was well done. A lot of red in the room, and now we turn back to the politics of a revolt in the Labour Party against the Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Thaddeus McCutter, American greatness. He's in the great state of Michigan. I am in New England, where it is not sunny, and I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Thaddeus McCutter, my colleague and friend, and we are in the south of France with Simon Constable, reflecting upon his excellent weather, more than not. But the weather back in London, Simon, good heavens. Keir Starmer looks to be under attack from his own roundheads. They want him to go. There's 100 signatories or near two in Labour asking him to step aside. At the same time, I believe last night there was the report that he had 100 signatures in favor of him. I can't tell the difference. Your measure of Starmer at this point, is this survivable? Because he has ambitions to stay PM all the way to 29.
Yes, theoretically, yes. However, what is very different about the Labour Party is that in addition to MPs having a big sway on the Prime Minister, there are also unions. These are labour unions, organised labour, and they have an outsized influence on what's going on with the leader and if the leader's suitable. And right now they've announced, look, we know that Keir Starmer has to go, and we must have a road to, you know, push him down or push him off the current role he's in, which is Prime Minister. And that seems to be in line with what most of the country would say if you asked them. The election a week ago that was a really bad one for Keir Starmer, you know, has been noticed. And if you want your people to vote for you again, you've got to get rid of someone who is unpopular. And he is very unpopular. I've not seen a landslide like this as an adult. I think there was a landslide when Margaret Thatcher came to office, but this is not good for the Labour Party to keep him around.
Thaddeus, do you have thoughts about Keir Starmer? Is he in trouble because all leadership is in trouble at this moment because of the Gulf, or is this a one-off for the British people?
Well, I really have a question for Simon, because we, as an outside observer, we saw that Labour had a tremendous victory when Keir Starmer came in, became president, prime minister. How did we get here where we are today?
it's a very good question. I mean, one of the things that I've witnessed in successful leaders of political parties is going for the low hanging fruit when you're first in office and saying, okay, what's easy for us to do? And instead of that, it seems to have been the opposite. So one of the first things that was done by Keir Starmer's government was to cut there is now again a winter heating allowance for elderly people beyond a certain age. There'd be some money so that you wouldn't freeze to death in your house. And that was stripped away almost as soon as he got in office. So that was the first bad thing. There were promises of more houses. Britain is 6 million houses short of where it should be compared to other developed countries in the European Union. I know we're not in the European Union, but we're still right there, really close to it. So 6 million, and they're putting out just maybe a couple of hundred thousand a year when they need millions of new homes, and they're not thinking about going upwards. There are many more things that have come along, such as a tax and an additional tax on employing people. So, of course, that made the unemployment rate go up and made it very hard for inexperienced people to get a job. This I could probably go on until midnight with this, and it's lots of things like that that people who are in office now don't really understand. So one of the other things that was tried on was saying, "Oh, we're going to tax landlords." Well, you know, the landlords, if they're going to lose money, will stop having flats or what we call flats or apartments or houses and stop letting them out because they don't want to lose money. I mean, it seems unreasonable to ask someone to do something and lose money at the same time if they don't want to. So it goes on and on and on and on and on. And it's very sad. And it's pretty obvious to anyone who knows even a little bit of economics of what's going to happen.
And Simon, Keir Starmer is hanging on. Does he have an explanation? We have 30 seconds as to why he could be so unpopular and want to be prime minister.
Well, I think that's ego. I think that's ego on his point. I think in the past we'd have seen people say, "Well, okay, we lost the election for our party. I'm going to step down, and we're going to get someone better than me." And that's a British way of doing things. And maybe it's not in America, but it is certainly historically that's what you do.
Simon Constable, writing for Barron's and the Wall Street Journal and other important publications. But he's in the south of France, where now and again it's damp. That's it. That is McCullough, American Greatness in the Great State of Michigan. I'm John Baxter. Thank you, Mr. Constable. I especially like the hooch part of your report.
It is so strong. It is eye-wateringly strong. And, I mean, it's a thing to be taken in small sips. The only person I've given it to try was a guy who grew up in Kentucky, and he was fine with it. He said, "Oh, this is quite mild." So so I was happy that he drank some of it. But anyway, lovely to see you, Thaddeus, and lovely to see you, as always, John.
Thank you, Simon.
Well, both of you.
We will. Thank you very much, Simon.
Cheers, Simon.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
We're back from planet Earth. This live streaming has its advantages when it works. My secret this morning was that I didn't touch my touchpad, so nothing blew up while we were talking. That is a risk. Momentarily, before we go, your measure of the contest in Washington right now, it seems frozen and not moving at all, whether it's the war, whether it's this spike in inflation that we're seeing, whether it's the price of gasoline chiefly is a debate. And then there's the matter of the Supreme Court redistricting. Is this business as usual, Thaddeus? There's so many different arguments, I've lost track.
No, I think it's we're heading into a very contested midterm. The Democrats are highly energized. Republicans are hoping things start to change and they start to see the dynamics shift in their direction. At present, they're not. At this point, you see President Trump is over in China. He's taking a bunch of business executives, CEOs over there, which shows that he's not certainly not over there to help decouple the United States economy from the communist Chinese, which I find that that's kind of a, at least from my perspective, problematical for the United States. But we'll see what he does. But the concern that a lot of us who understand the nature and the existential threat and the strategic danger that the communist Chinese regime poses do not want to see us continue to engage with them. We'd like to see us decouple from them. We would like to see the President of the United States understand the role of their ideology and why that makes them very dangerous to the United States, as well as their past practices, not only in terms of trade, but in terms of the geostrategic interests of the United States around the world that they are actively endangering, to see them to try to recouple and try to further enmesh our economy with them seems to me to be going the exact wrong way. And people like Gordon Chang and others who are very astute in this also share that concern.
Would you say the people of Michigan are suspicious of China in general?
You have a gift for understatement, Mr. Batchelor.
I wanted to make sure that it was a yes. I would say the people in Connecticut are suspicious of communist China as well.
Well, it's always the people. People are ahead of the politicians on this. They certainly seem to be ahead of this administration. And it's unfortunate because in 2016, 2024, even 2020, the thought was that we had a president who could understand the threat of this regime. It would not be beholden to the corporate interests. It would actually try to bring manufacturing back to the United States, would actually understand and stand up to the threat of the PRC, as opposed to throwing their arm around them, hoping they could find a transactional arrangement with them. There is no transactional arrangement with this communist regime. They are bent upon unrestricted warfare with the United States. They engage in it every single waking minute of the day, and there can be no accommodation. There can only be a strict containment policy and eventually a rollback policy that will free the Chinese people and allow them to pursue their God-given liberty with other nations.
That is not a minority opinion. It is surprising that the White House doesn't hear it, or if they hear it, they don't understand it.
I bet they hear it from large segments of that administration themselves. What the top does with it is up to the top.
That is McCotter, American Greatness in the Great State of Michigan, where he promises sunshine is on the way to New England. We could use a little of it, just a moment or two.
I never promised you a rose garden, Mr. Batchelor.
Thank you, Thaddeus. This is the making of the John Batchelor Show, and the Roman Orchestra is wandering around backstage. I'm going to bring them on. Thank you, everybody, and I'll see you in 23 hours. Thank you, Thaddeus.
Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto. It's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.